Hello, everyone. Yeah, it's late time.
It's the old
slides.
Oh, this is the old slides. Sorry about that. Yes, this is the right one. Yes. Yes. Hello, everyone. So I am Tejun and Johannes. We are from Facebook. And we want to talk about resource control at Facebook. So I want to start with this graph. So imagine a web server, right? A Facebook web server, which is running like filled up to the brim, right? It's saturated in terms of CPU, in terms of memory, in terms of disk. It has hard disk, too. So it's really filled up the brim, right? If you imagine a web server like that in a fleet like Facebook, there's a lot of management service going on, right? There's Chef running, which also runs Yum from time to time, and cron jobs, all the monitoring. So there's a lot of infrastructure pieces going on in the system, and imagine like one of those support services slowly leaking memory, let's say 10 megabytes per second. Right? You don't really notice at first, but it's going to add up pretty soon, and you're going to see problems. And if you think about, let's say you run a chef, and somebody wrote a wrong script, and that's kind of leaking memory. And it's not really an essential part of the system. You want it running, but you don't want your website to go down because of that. So it'd be really nice if you can protect your main workload, the web server, from those kind of things. So if you look at the purple line, that's the y-axis is RPS, requests per second, how many requests is processing. That's before what we did. So that red marker, 10 megabyte per second growth on both, means that we started a memory leak intentionally in one of those support services. And memory grows up, and your memory runs out, and whole machine crashes down, right? RPS drops, machine is thrashing now, it cannot really do anything else. And eventually, after like half an hour, the machine gets rebooted, and then it recovers, right? That's like a 40-minute recovery process. If this is happening at wide scale, right? Let's say somebody deployed a chef recipe, which it did that at the same time, that is taking down Facebook, right? I mean, that's the whole site going down. And the green line is what we did. Green line is the resource control. So we use that for resource protection and resource control kicking in. And while the RPS drops a bit, right, it holds on. And we did that 3 times, and the system, generally survives pretty well. There's minor annoyance. There's people experiencing some latencies in their use of Facebook, and some uncles getting paged, and that's about it. It's not a major event. So this presentation is about going from purple to green. How we did that. So we are resource control group or team at Facebook, and this is our motto or our mission statement: world conserving full OS resource isolation. So it's a bit of word salad, right? So let's unpack that. So the first thing, world conserving, right? World conserving means that we want to use the machine if there's work to do, right? We don't want to put, in resource restrictions in a way which limits the overall utilization of the machine, right? Because that's wasteful. We want control, but we don't want to be expensive doing it. The second part, full OS, is that if you imagine using a VM for resource isolation, it's a lot easier, right? I mean, you hard assign memory, you hard assign some disk capacity, you can pin CPUs. Resource control-wise, it's almost trivial. You can easily do that. But then you lose all the integration with the host system, right? You lose access to files on the host system. You can have other workarounds, but naturally. Or you can restrict IOs to direct IOs, right? That also makes the problem easier if you bypass memory management page cache. But these things all adds up to operational complexity. And so what we wanted to do was keeping to make resource control transparent to the rest of the system. meaning that applications and users can keep doing whatever they want, they have been doing, and whatever they want to do. And we want to layer resource control on top so that it just works transparently, right? You have the same system, and you you put resource control on top of it, and it just works the same except for the added resource control. That's what you want it to do. So if you think about like doing that, like imagine that we never had that, and we needed a project. We wanted a project which is simple and which we can demonstrate that this is useful and this is this is workable. So we chose a project called FBtext. So FBtext means that inside Facebook, that the tax that every machine has to pay to be part of the fleet, right? All the management and all the monitoring overhead that we have to pay, that part is called FBtext. And sometimes, as I said in the first slide, like the tax part misbehaves and brings down the system. So our initial project was, it'd be great if you can protect the main workload from the tax part. So that was FBtext, the name of the project. It became the name of the project. And as you can see from the two part, it's the FBtext 2, the first attempt just failed miserably, right? I mean, we did something we thought would be effective, and it just made the system more fragile, more brittle. Nobody was happy. So we had to go back to a drawing board and rethink everything. And so what was so challenging about it? I mean, it doesn't sound that difficult, right? I mean, how hard can that be? And the challenges were in almost all areas. In almost all areas. And the first was that memory that high-end max is the, or like in C group one terms, right, that'd be memory limit in bytes, would be the natural thing that people would think about when think about controlling memory distribution. What they do is that, it's saying that you can only have this amount of money, right? Memory. memory is money. So how we can do it for FBtext would be we can put a limit or for support services, right? You guys can only use, say, 4 gigabytes or 6 gigabytes. You can use no more. That didn't really work that well, because if you think about it, right, if you put in restrictions, that means that you are lowering overall utilization, right? When support services has to have more memory to run reliably, if you put in this artificial limitation, it can't. And the thing is that on systems which are running up to the brim, a lot of resources are nominally oversubscribed, and it's in temporary terms. So they have to be able to go over like these artificial limits sometimes. So this didn't really work. So at the moment we put in these artificial limits, the systems started failing more, and we had to inch up the limit to the point where it is not meaningful. So it just, we couldn't lower utilization to protect the workload because the system is already too busy. The other part was that kernel umkiller didn't really work well. The main reason for that is that kernel umkiller kicks in only when the kernel thinks that the kernel is in trouble, right? If the kernel cannot make forward progress, then umkiller kicks in and kills something to make forward progress. It doesn't really know or really care about whether your workload, your application is running fine or well. It doesn't know about that. So the system can easily enter a state where the kernel is thinking, everything is fine, while the application is thrashing for 20 minutes. That's what you saw in the first slide too. That's why the recovery takes 30 minutes, because for 20 minutes of that time, the kernel is not doing anything. It's thinking, oh, all is fine. So that was another challenge that we met in terms of memory control. And I/O control, I/O was hard too, maybe even more difficult. The first one is that we didn't have a good I/O controller to use. CFQ didn't really work well with SSDs, and even on hard drives, we had a lot of issues in the production, so we couldn't really use that. And there's another controller called I/O throttle, But I mean, that's the same thing, right? That's, that uses memory IO.max. So it limits the total amount of IO which can be done. And you know, the same story. You cannot limit and survive. And another thing is that you know, the BPS and IOPS is what IO.max uses. And they're just not a good measure of IO capacity, right? I mean, it's just really difficult to find a good configuration with those two parameters because they don't really reflect how expensive these IO streams are to the device. And another issue that we met was that that we were not accounting the IO controller, the C group IO controller part was not accounting file system metadata operations and swap operations. We'll get to swap, but you kind of need swap, especially with SSDs. It just makes more and more sense. And we were not accounting them properly, so we were charging them to the root C group, like to the system, and that caused a lot of priority inversion issues. And priority inversions. So we for the past couple of years, we have been really working hard at this problem. And you know, earlier this year, we thought that we nailed the memory controller, we nailed the I/O controller. It seems to be working, and then we tried to put them together and found out that nothing works. Nothing still works. And the main reason for that was that there are a lot of like major priority inversions in the system. For example, so the kernel basically assumes that everything in the system can make forward progress. Otherwise, it locks up. I mean, so if you like one process runs out of memory, right? What the kernel's basic assumption is that I gotta make that unstuck. Otherwise, the whole system is gonna stay still. So it throws everything priority configurations or whatever out of the window and tries to reclaim memory as hard as it can. It's just every other configuration becomes meaningless. But I mean, if you take that approach to resource control inside the system, right? Doesn't really work because we want to be able to slow down a part of system really badly while maintaining health of the a more important part of the system. So the kernel can no longer operate in a way which assumes that everything has to make progress, right? I mean, something is going to make a lot faster progress than some other things. And so this creeps up in a lot of areas, but usually around file system and I/O operations. So for example, EXT4, it can be fixed, but EXT4 in the data journaled mode, the default operation mode, can create hard data dependency through its journal. So like a high priority C group would have to wait for a lower priority IOs to finish before making progress. You cannot use that and get anywhere. And the file system metadata swap IO, yeah, those things are the same, right? I mean, low high priority, you need to make the distinctions, otherwise low priority can completely mess up high priority performance and latency. There's MFSAM. MFSAM is another interesting one. So MFSAM is something which protects a process structure, like a memory layout of a process. And one really interesting part is that when you do PS, right? The information, the command line comes from inside the memory of that process, right? So when you do PS, it has go inside the memory space of the target process and read that command line argument from there. And so that requires grabbing something called MFSAM. It's a read-write semaphore. And it is also a major source of priority inversion because sometimes you end up issuing IOs while holding it. So if a low priority IO holds it, issues an IDO, waits for low priority IO, and high priority comes in and runs PS, then it gets stuck and the whole system gets stuck with it. So it doesn't work. So those are a lot of those challenges. And there are a lot of others too, but those are the big ones.
So yeah. works now, right? Okay. So yeah, what do we do about all these things? There's a whole laundry list of problems. So first thing we started out with was to tackle the memory controller, because that was the first thing we configured in the first place. And like TJ mentioned, we had to completely move away from hard partitioning. The you get this, you get that. It just doesn't work. And instead switch to prioritizing instead the thing that has higher importance. And the advantage of doing this when you prioritize instead of partition is that if the higher priority thing is not running, the lower priority thing can just take all the resources it needs. By definition, that's just a lot more forgiving to configure, because the worst that can happen is there's too much competition. And that's there are no artificial kills, there's no artificial crashes or anything like this. If the configuration doesn't fully work, we can just adjust it and detect it while it's running. So for memory, the way this looked like, we implemented something called memory low and memory.min, memory low is the primary thing that we use. So instead of limiting something, you just say the main workload gets this much memory. If it wants more, it has to just compete with everything else that's running. But it's a competition between different jobs, and the higher priority one gets a leg up in that competition. So memory low is a best effort thing. So what we say is, unless there's severe memory pressure, the main workload gets more memory than everything else. And then if we're about to run out of memory and are threatened to bring down the entire machine, that's when we violate that guarantee and just go, okay, let's just make it work and don't crash. And then we also implemented memory min, which is for certain jobs where we would actually prefer an kill rather than letting an application not work. For example, SSH, because if the machine doesn't respond to SSH, it gets rebooted forcibly. So we'd rather kill something else than let SSH run out of memory. That's what we did for memory. Then we also kind of had no insight into how well our configuration was working. If you have multiple jobs sharing a machine, we actually didn't really know or weren't able to tell how much is the sharing of a host impacting the throughput and the latency of individual jobs. Like the kernel has a bunch of statistics and counters, like the page fault rate and reclaim activity, from which you could tell, okay, there's maybe a little bit of struggle in that workload, but it doesn't tell you how much longer does your operation if you're running shared versus if you have the whole host to yourself. And literally, the only thing you could do would be to have the application or the workload run on a machine on its own first, to establish a baseline performance and go like, okay, this is what the workload could do if it had the entirety of the resource available, and then you put it into a shared environment and compare it to that baseline, right? Now, that's extremely cumbersome. It's also almost impossible for a lot of our workloads because they do change all the time. We cannot really say this workload is always needing this much resources because our user activity changes. Right now, the US is waking up, so the workload is going to increase on our web servers and stuff like that. So that doesn't really work. And even if it did, the only thing it tells you, this workload is now taking longer to run if it's in the shared environment, but you cannot really tell the bottleneck is there, right? You can tell, okay, this now took, there's some latency here, this took longer to complete, but you only know the time. You don't really know why. This is where a thing called PSI comes, which is a feature we developed for the Linux scheduler. And what it does is it annotates all the points in the kernel where we have events that are associated with a lack of resource. So if the kernel enters page reclaim, for example, we know we ran out of memory and we have to do some work. That is not enhancing the workload, but just kind of making up for the lack of memory. There are other events like you're waiting for a busy CPU to become available. You're trying to run, everything is busy, so you kind of have to wait. So what PSI does is it annotates all these events and then aggregates what it's measuring into a share of total wall time or real time. So it gives you a percentage, so between 0 and 100%, that tells you how much of your overall runtime is the workload not productive because of a lack of resources. So if it, for example, reports 20% memory pressure, that means during 20% of all of the time that's elapsing, you're not actually doing work. You're just waiting for page faults to come back of recently evicted pages. You're waiting for a page reclaim. And that gives you a measure of how much productivity you're actually losing, and it tells you what resource is the culprit for that. So the whole thing works against the live system, so we don't have to do control runs or anything. So if we have a setup with multiple shared workloads, we can tell for every single workload at any given time if it's losing time right now on contended resources. So that obviously makes it a lot easier to configure our resource control configuration, because we can instantly tell this thing has too little memory. This is waiting on CPU more than it should. And so this helped a lot in getting the basic configuration right. And we can also use something that I would call being functionally out of a resource. So this is kind of tricky. As TJ mentioned before, when the kernel killer kicks in, that's a very specific event, which is you're trying to allocate a page, a piece of memory, and it tries to reclaim, and it fails, and it cannot allocate the single piece of memory. That's when the kernel goes, you're out of memory. But the thing is, even if you're at lower levels of memory pressure where this is not happening yet, you might already be functionally out of memory because you're spending like 60% of the time waiting for memory. So you're losing pretty much most of your production capacity, but the kernel killer is like, well, you're still making progress. So what this helps do, what this helps with is with detecting when you're functionally out of a resource. And it goes for CPU, it goes for memory, it goes for IO. And we can use this for several things. So one thing we did was for load shedding, where you have a service that would just go like, the latencies are now too high for every single request. And so I'm going to stop accepting requests and let some other machine handle it in order to avoid crashing and completely rebooting or hanging for a while. The other thing we do is we developed an enforcer of that. This is a project called UMD. It started kind of out as a small Python script that would just go, if you're waiting more than X percent for on memory, I'm going to kill something. Now, in the meantime, it's kind of developed into a much bigger thing. Daniel's here too. He's going to have a talk about that later. And it really does out of resource management for everything. It can monitor IO, it can monitor memory health, it can do all these things. So the thing this does is, as TJ mentioned before, the kernel killer doesn't kick in for a long time, so it's not really helpful in managing our workload health. And the other thing is, if it does kick in, the only thing it tries to do is keep the kernel running, so it just picks the biggest task in the system and just shoots it in the head. And now the thing is, our jobs are complicated, right? They're multi-process things, and they also have different priorities. And the kernel killer has no understanding, right? It just shoots something and then moves on. And when this happens, we actually have no idea what state we're in. So we had a couple of services that could just not continue if the kernel killer kicks in. So they basically enabled panic on and just had to reboot. It's like something died. I don't know what died. I'm the entire machine. So this is where UMD kicks in. The two things it does, first, distinction between when the kernel thinks you're out of memory and when we think we're functionally out of memory or functionally out of a resource where our production capacity is no longer adequate. That's completely workload dependent, right? Some workloads might be fine, they're waiting 20% on memory. Some workloads say, I have a little bit more latency, this is not acceptable anymore, my SLAs are not met. So this is what you can configure UMD to do. First, that you configure it, what is my trigger point here? What is my tolerance level for health? And if that's not met, then go do the other thing, which is kill something important. And again, something important is completely dependent on the system. It's dependent on the workload. And what that something is also dependent on, is that a single process or is this an entire C group you want to have taken out? People try to do kind of policy like this inside the kernel over the years, repeated, just doesn't really work to convey all this knowledge, convey what quality of service is to the kernel, to convey what workloads are. And that's why UMD sits in user space, because you can just configure that much easier. Now, for the I/O controller, as TJ mentioned, we cannot really know the cost of I/O. So if you can have a couple of IOPS already completely filling up the device, or you could have a couple of megabytes if it's really seeky and it's a lot of IOPS, also kind of fully utilized device. So it's really hard to say in advance how much is this going to cost. For SSDs, you might have a simple write, and all of a sudden the garbage collection run goes off, right? So it's hard to predict. So instead of trying to use these metrics like IOPS and bytes per second and all that stuff, what we do is we track completion latency. So every time you submit an I/O request, we just monitor how long it takes to complete. And then you can configure per C group what your tolerance level is, right? So you can say, if my IOs take longer than 50 milliseconds, for example, then throttle everything that has a lower guarantee. So if there's somebody else that has a 70 milliseconds guarantee, that thing's going to get throttled. Every time it tries to submit I/O or memory, that thing has got to wait. So again, this is work conserving. If the high priority thing is not running, then the low priority thing can just use the device however it wants. And that works for both hard disk and SSDs. The other thing the I/O controller does that we wrote is it supports things like teacher mentioned the metadata I/O, which is shared between all C groups, and also something like swap. Because if you're doing memory reclaim and you want to allocate some memory and you have to reclaim something, you're deciding I need to swap out some memory. That memory might not be yours, right? So you cannot be throttled according to who owns that memory that you're swapping. Otherwise, you might have the old priority inversions where you wait for a lower priority thing. So what this thing does is a concept called do first, pay later, where if there's memory reclaim, you're going full throttle, you're using all the disk I/O, but then you charge whoever owned that memory that you swapped out. And when that guy tries to allocate later, he gets throttled, or when he submits more I/O. So it's a put on his budget, but you're still moving at full speed to avoid that priority inversion. Which brings us to that. So yeah, that's a whole laundry list of things. There's really no magic bullet. We just kind of had to go through one by one and fix these things up. We switched to Butterfest to avoid the ext4 journaling issue. And then inside Butterfest, there were a couple of things we had to untangle. For the MMAP semaphore, first we did, the biggest offender was read ahead, because every time you access a disk on file, it doesn't just read one page, the one thing you're looking at, because that'd be a waste of an IOP. You could do a lot more with a single IOP. So it just reads ahead a couple hundred K. And if you're really heavily under memory pressure, it's not a good idea to try to allocate a couple hundred K and start IO when you're already maxed out on all the capacity. So we put a patch in to detect that situation and just abort read ahead and do page by page IO. That helped a lot, but it doesn't fully cover all the situations in which we still kind of had these hangs. So Joseph, who's not here, is also at Facebook. And I were working on completely avoiding any kind of IO under the MIPS semaphore, which is includes swap IO, page cache, which includes things like writing to a file in the file system, which has file system specific stuff. So it's kind of like slogging through all these things and patching it up. And then shared IOs, as I mentioned, do first pay later, where if you're trying to reclaim, it goes at full speed, but if somebody else tries to allocate or try to create more potentially memory that needs to be swapped, that guy gets throttled instead. Right, so how does this look in practice for us? So the first thing, we had to switch the ext4 root file systems on our machines to Butterfs. And that was actually kind of funny because we brought this up in the meeting that we have a priority inversion here and we should consider switching to Butterfs. And the team that handles these things kind of just took it and run with it. And after a couple of weeks, we had several hundred thousand machines converted to full-on Butterfs rootfs, which made our Butterfs developers sweat a little bit. But it's been pretty solid, and we have a 7-digit container image now, all on Butterfs, and it's running pretty well. All the priority inversions are being addressed. All the metadata is annotated and properly charged to handle these inversions. The other thing is we have swap pretty much everywhere. So some of our workloads, they're like 80-90% anonymous memory. And if you get into trouble with that, there's not a lot of breathing room for the kernel if you don't have swap. Because all that stuff is basically mlock. That's everything you get from malloc, that's tempfs. If you can't manage these and compress them or get them out of memory, you might be running OK in 1 second, and you might completely hit the wall in the next second, right? Because the distance between being OK and being out of memory is very small if you can't manage memory. The other thing is there's always a competition between your file system caches and anonymous memory. And if you can't swap, then you might be thrashing your file system caches and constantly reload the same stuff, while there might be anonymous memory that is completely unused. And you could just swap it once and be fine, and the system would run a lot better. So having swap enables us to do all this and is much better for memory utilization. The other thing that's useful when you do this is as you get into pressure, instead of hitting that wall, it just kind of gracefully decreases the memory bandwidth, and pressure builds up slowly until we hit what I mentioned earlier, that our tolerance for production capacity. Right? So at some point, UMD will notice, oh, you're spending a lot of time swapping. That's something I recognize as a problem, and just kill the unmanageable workload. And this is really important because I think everybody remembers how horrible swap can be. Because if it's fine, it's fine. And then sometimes the machine just goes out for lunch for minutes or hours. And UMD is really the key here because it can detect exactly when this happens. And it gives us all the upsides of swap and kicks in when things go haywire. So we have swap enabled pretty much everywhere except for the main workload. But that's only for right now because it really depends, again, what is the latency tolerance. And right now, the main workload's not really tolerating swap IO. So the cgroup setup is kind of like this. We have three major hierarchies. One is the workload itself, obviously, where the web server software sits. Then we have the system slice, which holds all the package management and the remote control of the system, the monitoring, the logging. And then we have something that's kind of in between called the host critical slice, which is neither the workload nor like that lower priority stuff, because if those binaries die, then the whole machine goes down. Something like SSHD, we detect and reboot the machine if it goes out. We also want reliable logging. We want UMD to work at all times because that saves our ass constantly. And so these are kind of set up. So we have the host critical is the only one that has a hard guarantee because we'd rather have kill go on and off on the host level than have any of these not be able to make forward progress. Then the workload gets the majority of the memory on these machines as a soft guarantee set by memory low. And then you can see the IO latency guarantees. Workload and host critical have the highest priority, and then system slice is below that because it's less important. UMD we configure in a way that primarily we protect the workload from what's going on in the lower priority system maintenance stuff. And we also protect the system thing from itself. So if there's any kind of if there's mid-level pressure in the workload, we kill something in the system. If there's high pressure in the system, we kill something in the system. Then we have triggers for I/O as well, just to make sure the workload gets the I/O bandwidth it needs in order to function. And we monitor swap right now to make sure that if we run out of swap real quick, then we also have to kill something. Yeah.
So these are the users that we are seeing. Let me see. Oh yeah, that's the first one. So these are the hard drive machines, web servers running, you know, fully saturated. So this is 10 megabyte per second memory leak started in the, you know, in the management part of the system. And on the green line, like the new one, the FPtext 2 protected one, right? It gets started 3 times. You know, RPS drops a little bit. But you know, UMD kicks, you know, memory protection and all the protections is working. So they are protecting workload while punishing the memory leak. And then UMD eventually recognizes that the, you know, the system is not in a healthy state and goes in and kills the memory bomb. And as a comparison, right, the base RPS just drops, the system just checks out, right? I mean, that line is not, you know, that straight line is not numbers not being reported, right? The system completely checked out, it stopped reporting anything. So like the graph drawer just, you know, draws straight line, and the system got rebooted and, you know, recovered after like half an hour. And this is a little bit faster memory leak, 50 megabyte per second, about the same story, but, you know, the dips are kind of deeper and the timeline more compressed. But, you know, same thing. And this is 100 megabyte per second. Even deeper dips, even faster timing, but the same thing. One thing really interesting in these graphs, I'm going to go to that later, but is that the top one, right, the green and the purple ones are the RPS, the resulting performance of the system. And the bottom graphs, right, these small things at the bottom are memory pressure numbers. And it's a lot more clear in the SSD cases, so I'm going to get to that later. Yes. And this is I/O protection kicking in. So we just started like untarling kernel package 3 times and touching them and removing them in the management portion. So it's kind of simulating, you know, YUM going haywire or something like that. And the interesting thing is that without the protection, the dips are deeper. I mean, but you know, it also ends faster, right? The untarring, the bomb workload finishes faster because it consumes more resources. That's expressed by those green bars, green and purple bars. So green bar shows that on the protected host, that bomb takes longer because, you know, its resources, you know, getting controlled. But also, you know, they are the main workload suffers less. And one of the interesting thing here is that Even these are all protected, they are still showing like these dips, right? Especially on the 100 megabyte one, it's kind of clear. I mean, there's a fairly dip, right? And the reason for that is because these are nominally oversubscribed, so we cannot protect it too hard because the system management actually needs to steal some IO capacity temporarily from workload for the system to stay healthy, because you know it's just oversubscribed normally because that's more efficient. So we cannot protect it kind of really strictly. That's why you know you see those dips. And going to the SSD, it gets a lot better. It's the kind of same test, but on SSDs. And look, if you look at the green lines, you know they barely dip, right? I mean they still dip a little bit because the you know kind of needs to figure out what's working and what's not. But you know, those are like small dips. Nobody cares. Nobody would even get paged over that, right? It's completely fine. Everybody can sleep peacefully. So you know, basically same story, right? Unprotected, the system just dips. They recover faster because SSDs are awesome. But you know, still we don't want that kind of dip. But look at you know, this one is less clear. Look at this one. So if you look at the bottom, right? These are like really small peaks here and higher peaks there. So one thing really interesting is that the blue line, which has like this medium peak, there's a memory pressure in system that slice. So there's the memory pressure that the memory bomb and the rest of management things are experiencing. The small, like tiny bump here is the memory pressure that workload slice is experiencing. So what's happening is that a kernel memory controller kicked in and made sure that you know the workload is getting enough memory while punishing system.slice, right? So it's biasing the memory pressure that way to protect the workload. If you look at this, the green and orange lines, they are still you know a little bit different because they are you know their behavior is different. But there's a system and workload for the unprotected system, and the pressure just kind of rises together and the system crashes, right? Nothing is being protected there. So yeah, that's the research. Now that we have, so this this might not be you know as exciting as you know yeah we succeeded at you know stacking multiple workloads and they all work perfectly. We are not there yet, but this does demonstrate that we now can protect or isolate resources comprehensively while maintaining like full OS features. If you think about it, right? If you can protect your main workload from system management stuff, right? Nothing prevents you from like you know loading like a side workload, like a batch workload in the system that slice, and you know the system would be just be happy, right? Because it's fully protected. So that's what we are gonna try next, pretty soon. This keeps sliding down, we're gonna try to load some batch workload, you know, next to our main workload, and we'll try to make sure that you know main load is not disturbed at all. So that would be our next step towards workload stacking with you know full transparency. And eventually, we still need some features, especially on the I/O side. But you know, we will start experimenting with you know putting heterogeneous workloads on a single system while fully controlling how resources are used across them without using utilization. So this was on our to-do list. All right, and most of these features are already upstream. Some of them are not yet, but like in the next version, next release, or the one after that, the kernel release, they should have everything upstream, so you guys can use it the same way we use it. And all of this is documented on this website. You actually don't need the hashtag now. We dropped that, so you can go to. I mean, it still works with hashtag, but it looks kind of worse. You can go to opensource.fb.com/linux, and you know it lists. Like, it has these icons, and you know there's a C group 2, PSI, BPF, all these things, and then you know you can go to the website, and there's a fairly good quality documentation, so you can learn more details about them. All right, so that was it. Any questions? Are we out of time? Okay.